Welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear about EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt's unannounced visit to East Chicago, Lauren Chapman reports on a deportation vigil in Indianapolis, Governor Eric Holcomb is planning a trip to Israel and Europe, and Chris Nolte has a conversation about a proposed concentrated animal feeding operation on a certified organic dairy in Newton County. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. U.S. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt and Governor Eric Holcomb made an unannounced visit to a lead-contaminated neighborhood in East Chicago before Pruitt authorized $1.7 million for soil removal at more than 25 homes. Pruitt and Holcomb arrived Thursday morning near the former Federated Metal site in Hammond, where they spoke with at least one property owner before Pruitt left. Holcomb tells the Times that Pruitt signed a memorandum for the cleanup work that will start in May. Hammond resident and former EPA attorney David Dabberton called the visit disingenuous political theater. He says Federated Metals closed more than 30 years ago and that nearby lead processing facilities still operating are the more likely source. Pruitt is facing investigations of outsized travel and security spending as EPA's leader. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is considering revisions to 2015 legislation that regulates the disposal of coal ash, but opponents in Indiana say cutting back on them could have serious negative side effects. The proposed revisions would allow individual states to set their own standards for coal ash disposal and more clearly defines the circumstances that would require a plant to clean up any non-groundwater releases. The EPA says the revisions could save between 31 million and $100 million each year. But environmental advocates argue those regulations protect residents living near the landfills. Dr. Indra Frank is the environmental health director for the Hoosier Environmental Council. She spoke Tuesday at a public hearing hosted by the EPA to get feedback on the proposed revisions. Frank says the changes allow plants to create their own standards for protecting groundwater reserves and checking for contamination. She says having that individual standard doesn't make any sense at all.
If groundwater is contaminated with a chemical, people in one part of the country don't have a different physiologic reaction to that chemical than in any other part of the country.
According to the Hoosier Environmental Council, 15 Indiana coal plants are regulated by the current rule. Frank says the EPA is trying to move the revision along quickly, allowing for a single public hearing. The EPA is accepting public input on the proposed regulations until April 30th. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. A federal agency has awarded Indiana nearly $11 million for the second straight year to fight the state's opioid abuse crisis. The Health and Human Services funding is among $485 million recently awarded nationwide to combat heroin and opioid abuse. Indiana was awarded $10.9 million, the same amount it received last year. That funding supports a variety of prevention, treatment, and recovery services for people addicted to opioids. U.S. Representative Susan Brooks says the federal money provides a greater sense of hope to people suffering from substance abuse, their families and law enforcement, first responders and medical personnel working on the epidemic's front lines. The grant will be administered by the state of Indiana, which will determine funding for specific programs. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. Governor Eric Holcomb is planning economic development trips to Israel and Europe that will include taking the first nonstop commercial flight from Paris to Indianapolis in May. The Indiana Economic Development Corp says Governor Holcomb will lead an ag biosciences-focused delegation to Israel during a May 6th through May 11th trip. The delegation's activities will include attending AgriTech Israel Conference in Tel Aviv. Holcomb will lead another group to Europe on May 18th with planned meetings with government and business officials from Germany, Austria, Switzerland, France, and Slovakia. The governor is planning his Indiana return May 25th on the inaugural Delta Airlines flight from Charles de Gaulle Airport to Indianapolis. These will be Holcomb's fifth and sixth international economic development trips as governor. He's previously gone to Europe, Japan, India, and Canada. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. Religious leaders in Indiana accompanied an Indianapolis woman on notice for deportation to her mandatory immigration check-in on Tuesday and held a vigil to protest her situation. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports, they say it is unjust and people have a moral obligation to protect her.
Erica Fierro immigrated to the U.S. when she was 5 and has 2 U.S.-born children. Her pastor and the Catholic Archbishop of Indianapolis, Charles Thompson, attended her immigration check-in, asking for a credible fear interview, which would allow her to go before a judge and halt deportation. But that didn't happen.
Deportation still, it's still going. It continues its process.
Archbishop Thompson says the entire Catholic Church is called to help people like Erica Fierro.
Pope Francis reminds us, those are the people we have to walk with and stand with. This is one of these moments with Erica in this very vulnerable moment in her life, and not only in her life, but the life of her family.
Fierro was warned during her check-in that she may only have a few weeks to get her affairs in order, including custody of her children. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. For more breaking news, here's Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney.
The natural gas utility company for most of northern Indiana could increase its rates by about 15% under a new deal it has reached with the State Consumer Advocate's Office. The proposed increase for Merrillville-based Northern Indiana Public Service Company, NIPSCO, would be smaller than the 23% rate hike the utility first requested last year. NIPSCO could see a projected $95 million boost in annual revenue. If approved by the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission, customers would see a 2-year phase-in in the highest rates starting in late 2018. NIPSCO says its base gas rates haven't gone up in more than 25 years and needs to increase to pay for pipeline safety improvements for some of its 820,000 gas customers. Indiana Utility Consumer Counselor Bill Fine calls the increase, quote, fair and equitable, end quote. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Tom Maloney.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Join us Tuesday, May 8th, starting at 6 p.m. for live election night coverage here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org and on social media, follow the hashtag NWIPolitics.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A growing number of education and treatment programs support children and adults with what's called trauma-informed care, where caregivers, social workers, and teachers recognize that childhood trauma can manifest in behavioral and mental health challenges. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on a Marion-based after-school program with this motto, Assume Trauma Before Drama.
Traditionally, when children in aftercare programs or schools had an emotional outburst, the caregiver lens could be, they're just being difficult. We're not focused enough.
That's what we were saying before.
Michelle Gwaltney is the executive director of Families First, a nonprofit that works with families in crisis and one of many in the state working to establish trauma-informed care programs. She says behavioral challenges used to be met with,
What is wrong with this child? What is wrong with this adult? What is wrong with this parent? But now we're saying, what has happened?
What has happened? An unstable family environment. The loss of a loved one to an opioid overdose. No job. Nothing healthy in the house for your children to eat. Just a few of the possible answers. An 1880s historic home sits on the property of the Marion Public Library. It's the home of a trauma-informed after-school program. The Brain Kitchen.
And it was just empty. And so when we approached them about the possibility of using this house, they were excited, we were excited, and it was...
Amanda Drury is a professor of youth ministry and practical theology at Indiana Wesleyan in Marion. She became interested in trauma-informed care models while counseling women who had been sexually abused. She didn't understand the shame.
And I said, well, boy, help me understand that. What do you mean here? And she said, well, if I had been gang raped instead of just date raped, then that would justify why I feel this awful.
Like many Indiana communities, Marion struggles with issues connected to poverty and addiction.
Well, even the location of our house right now is known for being a drug-infested area. A number of the houses that are surrounding the Brain Kitchen have been condemned, or we've got squatters in there.
This is the first year for the Brain Kitchen, and the 15 children here are bused in from Jay County, one of the poorest in the state. The trauma-informed curriculum was developed with the help of professors at Indiana Wesleyan. It uses movement to calm and focus the brain. Drury gave this example of a finger-touching exercise one child used after she got in a fight.
And she did that over and over and again, and you could see the anger start to leave her body until she was just sitting there, breathing calmly. And I remember just whispering, "Do you see what you did?"
Michelle Gwaltney with Families First says there's a growing number of these programs because of a growing understanding that accounting for adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, can explain behaviors like short attention spans or anger outbursts.
That there's a reason behind this, and maybe if we had a little bit more compassion and understanding about the reason, we may be more successful with this child.
Beyond emotional tools, trauma-informed programs like the Brain Kitchen can also address other root causes, including food insecurity, thus, kitchen. Today, some of the children learn to make fresh pasta. One has plans to open a pizzeria. They learn about healthy food, environmental science, gardening, and composting.
So you can put an organic cotton sock on one side and a Twinkie on the other, and within a matter of time, the organic sock is gone, but the worms won't even touch the Twinkie.
The hope is that the children will take some of these lessons home.
This little guy had made his soup. He went home to his house, which did not have electricity, by the way, and he shared his soup with his neighbors. And just the sense of pride and accomplishment that comes with knowing I can do something like this, I can bring life to my community.
Drury is looking for more grants to support another year for the Brain Kitchen. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Statistics show Black men suffer disproportionately from diabetes and high blood pressure, among other health concerns. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, a statewide initiative is working to increase awareness of health issues among African Americans, including visiting some popular conversation spots.
It's a busy Saturday afternoon at the Infinity Men's Salon just north of downtown Indianapolis. There are several chats happening in the shop, but amid the sounds of clippers and music, two volunteers sit at a table asking people if they want to participate in a free health screening.
Hi, how are you?
You want your blood pressure, blood glucose check real fast?
Tracy Scott is a medical assistant and is checking blood pressure, blood sugar levels, and body mass index, some of the statistics that can indicate health issues affecting Black men.
In the Black culture, African-American culture, high blood pressure, diabetes, being overweight, obviously that's very prominent.
She says she hopes bringing the screenings into a comfortable social setting will convince more of the barbershop's customers to seek preventative care.
You have a lot of people that walk in the door, especially on a Saturday. So, I mean, it's better than being in a clinic because you're not going to get as many people who've not been screened that walk into a clinic.
This is the eighth year of the Black Barbershop Health Initiative in Indiana. And these sorts of conversations have been happening all month as Black men get a trim or a shave.
You gotta get your blood pressure down, man. Take when we get done, man.
Nah. It's only gonna take you, man. Infinity Men's Salon manager Richard Gladney has participated for several of those years and says he's encouraging all his customers to get tested.
The barbershop is like a cornerstone of our neighborhood and in the Black community. And there's always a stigma with Black, especially Black men, not going to the doctor. So for some of us, this would be the only checkup we get. And so it's a place that a lot of Black men come to. So it all comes together and works out perfect.
There are customers that turn down the offer, but eventually one approaches the table to get screened. 19-year-old Caliente Macklin sits down and rests his left arm on a table to check his blood pressure.
142 over 98.
It's a little high, which doesn't surprise him.
I did have a heart attack back in December. It pretty much puts me on my toes to be aware of my health, to make sure I'm in good standings, because I got other people depending on me, like family members, my fiance, my brothers and sisters.
Macklin's had uncles die in their 40s because diagnoses of heart disease came too late to be treated. So he's glad he took advantage of the screening. Macklin says he likes the initiative, but wishes it was more widespread.
I actually think it's a good idea. It should be in multiple places, because never know, there's somebody who wants to come by, wants to get their blood sugar checked, or wants to know if they're in good health standings, or just to figure out overall if their actual weight is their actual weight. So,
medical volunteer Tracy Scott says the screening also allows her to teach people about clinics nearby.
And then we also have literature also that we hand out, and showing people that there are free clinics in their areas that they can go to. A lot of people just don't realize that, they don't know. And information, knowledge is power.
Shop manager Richard Gladney says he's proud of the turnout and wishes the event could happen more often.
Once a year is definitely not enough, because it's only on one day and we're open 7 days a week. So there's a lot of people that's not getting the experience. So even if you continue to do it on a Saturday, which is good because it's a busy day, it needs to be more Saturdays throughout the year so more people can experience it.
3 o'clock rolls around, ending the 6-hour outreach. Looking at the final list of participants, about 20 people took part in the screening. That's a record turnout for this particular shop, and a sign that buzz may be growing about the need for more health screenings. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. April is Parenting Awareness Month, Indiana, and locally based Indiana Parenting Institute uses the occasion to help educate and support people in the critical task of parenting. Jenna Baletza, Vice President of Strategic Partnerships and Branding for the local chapter in Gary, says Parenting Awareness Month is about drawing people's attention to parenting and the challenges that it presents. She talked about it with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson.
Now, PAMI's whole purpose, or we call it PAMI, so Parenting Awareness Month Indiana. So its whole purpose is to get folks' attention on parenting. You know, the struggles of it, the challenges of it, and the rewards of it. You know, we want folks to take this opportunity to acknowledge and celebrate the parents that are part of their organization, part of their church, part of their community. You know, and to get us realizing that that job that we can sometimes be very critical about is not very easy. And so at times they need assistance, and understanding that instead of being critical of the outcomes from their parenting, we'll be more inclined to support them and to help guide them in the right direction, if you will. So that's what April is Parenting Awareness Month Indiana is all about.
So what other events do you have planned for Parenting Awareness Month Indiana, and why is that month important?
The reason we chose April is because of the Prevent Child Abuse campaign.
I wanted to like get a quick recap of April is Parenting Awareness Month Indiana, and what your goals were for that, and maybe just a quick recap of some of the events.
So I don't know if you are also aware, but April is also Prevent Child Abuse Month. And so kind of our corollary to that movement was to, or to that initiative, was to do an initiative called April's Parenting Awareness Month Indiana. And basically what that does is draw attention not just to child abuse prevention, but also to the really tough task of parenting. And so it's an opportunity and a time for us to acknowledge our parents, to reach out to them if they're doing a great job and letting them know that we see the great job that they're trying to do as they raise their child, or if they're struggling, to be there for them in their struggle and to let them know that we support them even through their struggles. If there's anything that they need, to please, you know, reach out to us, or here's some information or here's some resources that you can access to make that job a little easier. You know, I think the important thing about solving a problem is getting our focus on it, because once our focus is on something, together, especially, we can come up with solutions for it, you know. And so if we're all only looking at the negative outcomes of parenting as opposed to also highlighting those positive outcomes, we fail an opportunity to give people examples of what good parenting looks like, because a lot of us learn by example. In fact, I'd say a high majority of us learn by example, you know, and that's what teaching is in those younger years, and giving them those opportunities to see something to emulate, I think, is a positive thing in the end, as opposed to consistently remanding them about the things that they aren't doing right. Right. So, and then instead of, you know, reprimanding them for not doing something correctly, you know, showing that empathy and compassion to get them in the right direction. So that's what we wanted to give to parents, so that it's not a month of, you know, of highlighting the mistakes that parents have made, but also an opportunity to give them that support as they're being made aware of some of the bad choices that they've made and the outcomes of those bad choices.
So do you guys have, like, extra educational programs during that time, during April?
Well, what we try to do is, it's kind of really a branding thing, if I may be bluntly honest, in terms of we want parents to know activities that that they can feel safe or pro-parenting, for lack of a better word. You know, so it's either pro-family, pro-parenting, a place where they can go get some great information to help them be better caregivers to their children, or it's something that they can bring their whole family to, you know. So that's what we want. When folks see the April is Pammy logo, they know that it's pro-parents, pro-family, and those kind of things. And so we launch the initiative every year with a breakfast where we kind of, the point is to kind of rev up the community to focus on as parents for a month, right? And to do things to recognize them, honor them, and those kind of things. And then what we do throughout the month is partner with organizations, get our PAMI logo on there so that it makes parents aware that this is an event that's either going to help me as a parent or it's going to help me do family-oriented things with my kids.
What do you think the biggest challenges are for parents in parenting?
I think that the biggest challenge is when we get stuck in, as we learn, as we as human beings progress, we learn more things, right? So we have to make changes to stuff. A lot of times, I think we fear change because we give it this personal value, you know, to our identity, meaning that, you know, we weren't smart enough or that we aren't good enough or whatever, as opposed to realizing things change. You know, this wouldn't be life if it didn't change. And so allow yourself to be wrong, because you will, as we learn more, you'll find things that were stat may not be stat anymore. And so be willing to, you know, especially if something isn't working out that you're trying to do that you learned from a parent or you saw somebody else do, that you reach out and get information about that, because maybe they've learned something. We've got a different generation who responds to things differently because they have this thing called technology that we didn't have. You know, so don't be afraid to reach out and get that information that you need. It's not a negative reflection on you if you come up on something that you don't know. And I think that that's a lot of the issue that we see with the parents that we work with, is that fear factor of being judged on some level, and I think that that's really sad. I think that I kind of blame, and blame is such a strong word, but I think it's a part of our culture, you know, to have this air of self-sufficiency and that I know everything and that I can do everything. And if I could do anything, I would change that and realize that it's okay that we need each other, because as human beings, we need each other. You know, there are gifts that you have, Sharon, that I will never have. So my knowing you is a benefit to both of us, because I can give things to you and you can give things to me, right? And so I think that part of the American way really de-emphasizes that critical component and instead pushes you to be this superhero, you know, that can do everything. And I'm like, I would love to see that go away, so you have less and less parents being reluctant to go and ask for help.
On its website, Indiana Parenting Institute has a page called Relive the Moment, on which it places videos, pictures, and recaps of various kinds from the organization's events. Beletza says anyone interested in Indiana Parenting Institute's past events can scroll the page and view the presentations from previous events all the way back to 2012. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Public Broadcasting stations will bring you the third televised debate between Republican Senate candidates Todd Rokita, Mike Braun, and Luke Messer. Vote informed.
Join us Monday evening at 6 o'clock here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Carl Lissick, host of Green Fleet Radio, which is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities, talking with Trey Wadsworth, Director of Transportation for Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Green Fleet Radio. Today, our guest is Mr. Trey Wadsworth. He's the Director of Transportation for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, or NERPC. Trey, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carl.
Well, I know NERPC is the Metropolitan Planning Organization, or MPO, for Lake Porter and LaPorte counties, but what should our listeners know about what MPOs do?
MPOs were created by the federal government back in the 60s to help make sure that local priorities were reflected in transportation investments in their areas. So we really work with all of our local communities to make sure that the federal transportation dollars we receive in the region are used effectively and towards the priorities that really are reflected by what our customers need.
You know, Trey, I know a lot of people, you know, work, all of our communities work with NERPC, and I know that you're relatively new to NERPC, and why don't you tell our listeners where you're from?
I'm originally from upstate New York. I started my career in Boston, Massachusetts, working for the Massachusetts Department of Transportation. Got some great training there, and I'm using it here in northwestern Indiana now.
And we're so glad you're here. And so when you talk about planning initiatives, what kind of planning initiatives are underway at NERPC?
Right now, we're kicking off the development of our next long-range plan. Every 4 years, we're required by our federal partners to update our long-range plan. It looks out at least 20 years into the future to see what kind of investments into our transportation system are needed. So we're going to get underway on updating the plan, and we're going to look out to 2050 this time.
So as we talk about, what kind of things guide the development of this 2050 plan?
In large part, there are some federal requirements that guide it, some of the national planning goals, but as most importantly are the priorities of the region from the people we hear from.
And so what are some of the issues that the 2050 plan will address?
Yeah. So we are going to be actually taking a very interesting approach to this plan using what we call a qualitative scenario planning process. And that mm-hmm. sounds a lot very wonky, but it allows us to envision different types of futures that mm-hmm. we might experience. So we're going to investigate different influences and trends that the transportation system and other issues like the environment and economic development are currently experiencing. So for instance, one of the things we will look at as an influence is technology.
Sure.
And how that's changing the transportation system. For instance, our partners in Chicago have been doing a lot of research about how Uber and Lyft mm-hmm. are impacting the transit system. Here in the region, it could be very different for us because they could connect people to opportunities in a way that we currently can't with the transit systems we have today. But trying to understand those influences mm-hmm. And understand how they'll impact our future. Another one is demography. Who lives in the region and how sure. is it changing?
Mm-hmm. A lot of change going on. And I know, all the NERPC meetings are publicly open. And, you know, we would suggest that, folks get involved with some of this public planning. So how can people actually participate in this plan?
Yep. So we are actually underway now on reaching out to folks to participate in the long-range plan. We have four different periods in which we're going to be working with the public to set the priorities for this plan. The first engagement effort is going to be setting the vision for the plan mm-hmm. and trying to make sure that we've got the direction that we want collectively as a region, and then we'll be doing surveys, public meetings, and so we hope folks can participate in those.
Sure, and how can people find out about NERPC and some of the other great programs that you're working on?
One of the best ways is social media, of mm-hmm. course. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter as well. You can sign up for our emails and if you can, come in person.
Absolutely. So as we talk about the future of Northwest Indiana and we talk about, some of these trends, is there a model that we follow here with NERPC? I know there's not a perfect model or perfect scenario, but is there a model?
One of the best ways to do that, I think, is to look at some of our peer regions around the mm-hmm. nation. There are some instances where Northwest Indiana is in many ways connected to a larger metropolitan area like Chicago. So looking at some of those other examples, there's a region in southeastern Massachusetts that's very connected to Boston, mm-hmm. but has the same kind of composition that we have here with smaller cities spread across a region. So seeing how they handle the issues with being next to a big city, as well as having a whole bunch of little smaller cities in the region and connecting all those people and jobs.
A huge undertaking. as just recently, I know that the president in Congress and Senate passed the omnibus bill, and you know I know that there's a big influence on improving infrastructure. And how will that impact Northwest Indiana?
Because we principally do program federal investments. Funding for transportation. We're looking forward to those resources coming into the region mm-hmm. and working with our communities to identify the best projects to make for our people.
And then as we look forward to the 2050 analysis, what are some of the things that you might anticipate that might be coming out that is different than now?
Potentially looking at different partnerships that we can build mm-hmm. with different organizations throughout the region, as well as really focusing in on some of the major investments that are about to get underway, like the South Shoreline Extension and double tracking. Where can we best harness those investments to make an impact for the region in terms of jobs and connectivity to those jobs and new and great places to live.
Absolutely. And again, I think it's an exciting time to be involved with transportation planning, and we're excited to be a partner with NERPC, and we look forward to all these different activities that are going to continue to happen. But as we come to the end of our program, Trey, is there any closing thoughts that you would have for any of our listeners and for the future of transportation here in Northwest Indiana?
I just really hope everyone can participate in the planning process. You know, for me as a professional in planning, I love it, of course. Mm-hmm. So I'm a nerd about transportation planning. I hope everyone else can find their inner nerd to join us.
Well, again, I think it's just that you know, we've seen our public participation in a lot of these meetings going up, you know, the activities with social media and just the things, you know, sometimes people can't make meetings, but there's other opportunities for them to be involved in this planning process. So we're excited that you're here. Welcome to Northwest Indiana. We look forward to working with you. Look forward to having you back on the show very shortly to give our listeners updates on what's going on with NERPC. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Trey Wadsworth, Director of Transportation for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. John Kane, host of Eye on the Arts, talks with Tricia Hernandez of South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Tricia Hernandez, Director of Marketing and Development for South Shore Arts. Welcome, Trish.
Thank you, John.
So every year at this time of year, we start to gear up for the annual Beaux-Arts Ball.
We do.
And this year, it's the 25th annual Beaux-Arts Ball.
Yes. It's a milestone.
It's a big milestone. It is indeed. So every year we have a fun theme, and we try to make a lot out of it. We do everything in our power to make a lot. So what's in store this year?
So mainly this year we're talking about 25 and celebrating the fact that for 25 years we've been in the community raising money for education programs, art education programs, bringing them to the community, bringing the community to us. And so it's pretty cool to have something like a fundraiser like this that has gone on for 25 years and has escalated to a point where we reach like 30,000 kids mm-hmm. every year with the money that we get from this. This helps support everything in our ed department. So it's June 1st.
Friday, June 1st.
We're excited about the Nicole Jamrose Band, too.
Yeah.
She's
Live entertainment.
Live entertainment.
And somebody really beloved in the community, too.
Absolutely. And she does a lot of good. She'll do a lot of good dance covers mm-hmm. and just some of your favorite music. So that'll be a lot of fun.
So plan to stay to the bitter end.
Plan to stay to the bitter end.
Which is midnight, by the way.
Right,
then
right.
We all turn back into mice or whatever.
Right. You kick everybody off the dance floor. Uh-huh. And most people do. A lot of people stay till midnight.
They do.
It's a lot of fun. So we'll have a live and silent auction. Your ticket includes your dinner, your cocktails, and just a lot of fun. Great, great auction stuff.
We don't know what all of it is this year, certainly, by any means. But some of the things we've had in the past are a week in Jamaica for 12 people. That was a fun one.
Mm-hmm.
We've had the mystery dinner.
The mystery dinner, exactly.
It's always a mystery where it's going to be, where it's going to take place, and when, and who's going to cook it.
But it's still fun because somehow it all comes together for
the mystery dinners, and it's so fun. And this people pay $5,000 for an unknown.
Exactly.
Yeah, they just trust us.
Yeah. It's a good thing after all these years. This is your 25th ball.
Oh, God,
my 14th.
Remind me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
I always thought maybe by the 25th we could do the Gone with the Wind ball, and that would be, you know, my swan song. But it doesn't look like that.
It doesn't look like that's going
to
happen.
I'm not quite close enough to Medicare yet to pull that off.
To pull that off. So June 1st, and all of our auction items will be up, and you can bid on them even if you aren't coming at artsball.gesture.com. So the ball has gone mobile, and so
and it's gone worldwide.
And worldwide.
Yeah.
So that's very exciting. And if you want to donate, you can just give me a call at 836-1839. I am at extension 107.
And it is a good opportunity for businesses to promote themselves. And now that we're worldwide through this electronic auctioning service, you really do get incredible exposure.
You do. You do. Great. So everybody gets a lot of recognition, and certainly we appreciate anything you can donate to
us. So if somebody wants to give us a car.
A car would be nice.
A fancy car.
Yeah. Just throwing it out there.
Well, why not? That
of
would
course.
Be, that would be, we would give you spectacular
Somebody gave us a piano one year, remember? That was cool. Wasn't it an electric
yes,
piano
they did,
or
indeed.
An organ? Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was from their home. I think that
could
was,
have been.
Wasn't it a private?
Could have been, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but we do get a lot of art, obviously, because we're an arts organization.
Yes.
So the art alone is pretty fun.
Yeah.
The David Hugs, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I wonder what David will do for 25. We'll have to I'll have to discuss that with him. Well, anyway, so the ball's coming up. It's always
June
a big,
1st.
Big event attended by 400-plus people. It's black tie.
It is.
And although sometimes people dress in the theme. Mm-hmm. Our theme this year, we should say, Judith Mayer has created a kind of a pop art pinball machine look to the 25. And I like your slogan about keep the
ball is rolling.
The ball is rolling. I love that. Mm-hmm. That's very cute. Okay, Trish. Well, good luck with the event, and I'm good luck to both of us.
Yeah,
and
I was going to say
us.
We're in this together.
Yeah, no. Yeah, good luck for you. And thanks for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Kevin DeYoung of Natural Prairie Dairy on a proposed concentrated animal feeding operation in Newton County.
The name DeYoung is not unknown for folks here in northern Indiana and dairy farmers or farmers in general. We know that the entire town of Highland was founded by Dutch farmers, which is something that Will didn't even know. We talked about that here as we began our conversation. Tell us about the DeYoung family in particular, how they've gotten involved in dairy farming in particular in I guess the Plain States and now the move to northern Indiana.
Sure. No, and like you said, dairy farming is very much a little bit of a Dutch tradition. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest, I'm a fourth generation dairy farmer. Mm-hmm. My grandparents immigrated from the Netherlands in the 1950s with not much in their name, and they saved up enough money to buy a dairy farm in the 1980s in California with about 100 cows on it, and over time we've been able to grow and eventually moved into to Texas and call that's where we call our home for Natural Prairie, and now we are looking at a great opportunity to expand into Indiana.
Now, how did because your family members, the DeYoungs, come up from Texas to northern Indiana? Did you just talk to family members, other members of the family, perhaps extended family, about the opportunities to come into Newton County? What made this area near the Kankakee River in northern Newton County attractive for an organic dairy farm, to be sure?
Sure. You know, there's a lot of great things about Indiana that kind of brought us here. You know, one of the first things was simply an opportunity for us to expand our business and be closer to, I guess, the Midwest as well as the East Coast. In addition to that, Newton County really is a strong farming area with great farmers. The farm itself has a long production history. And one of the things that actually got us really excited about coming up here is the sandy soil. That's great for drainage, and that's great for grazing cows out on pasture.
Tell us about the area that you have all moved into and where you're establishing the farm now.
Sure. It's on the northern part of Newton County. I believe we're about 5 to 6 miles south of the town of Lake Village. And it is a land base of about 2,500 acres. And we've been farming it organically for almost 3 years now. It is a three-year process to convert land that was farmed conventionally and to turn it into organic farmland. Mm-hmm. So over the past 3 years, we've been already farming it organically. And when I talk about organic, I'm talking about no pesticides, no fungicides, no herbicides. And then in terms of the inputs, we're really talking about no genetically modified seeds or inputs for that matter.
Now, what do you grow on the farm right now?
So right now we have it established mainly in pasture grasses, alfalfa mm-hmm. and pasture grasses, and that's a big component of what we plan on doing there is grazing naturally outside with our cattle.
I was going to ask you if that's where the dairy cows come in. You have to look for some grazing land, of course, and that's what you say you're going into. So this way you have certified organic milk that will come from the cows. Tell us about the stock, the livestock coming in.
Sure. Right now they're all based in Texas. And when the facility is up and running and we are certified organic, we'll have the cattle up here in Indiana. And, you know, I guess the main purpose of what we're trying to establish right now is really getting that ground ready and getting our pastures ready, because one of the requirements of organic farming is that they have to be out on pasture for 120 days of the year mm-hmm. and making sure that we have a good feed base for them and a good pasture setup.
Now, when you have cows coming in and they're going to be spending so much time, as you say they will, in grazing on the land here, coming up here to northern Indiana, you're getting familiar with how the winters are. We are luckily now we're going into the nice weather months. Going through spring and summer, of course, and fall will be fine. But come winter, they're going to be needing to spend some time, I'm sure, indoors. Or they're going to be spending some grazing time, I'm sure, out. But they're going to have to spend some time indoors. What do you have to do to get an organic farm like this ready for the months where they can't be outside?
Sure. No, and that's certainly something we've had to look into in terms of setting up the facility for these colder weather months. Mm-hmm. But again, it comes down to we're only going to be putting our cows out on pasture when the weather is right for it. And we certainly won't be putting cows out to pasture in non-growing conditions or wet or soggy conditions. It really needs to be the ideal conditions. So it's all about doing what's best for the land and doing what's best for our animals.
The website talks about something which is called traceability, and what does that mean for an organic farm like the natural prairie dairy farm?
Sure. What it comes down to is we like to call it from grass to glass. Mm-hmm. Pretty much taking, and this is part of our organic certification and requirements, is we need to keep records and really trace out every single input that we're putting on the farm, every single pass that we're doing on the farm, making sure that we have a strong record of where exactly our cows are going, how they're being fed, and that's all part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you're going to have cows on the farm and an organic dairy farm as you're working on now, besides having the pasture for them to graze on, they have to have water. What do you do for as far as providing well water and other sources of water for the animals?
Sure. No, we have well water set up on the facility for the animals. Mm-hmm. And then also when they're grazing, we do have water available for them then. And the great thing about our site is that, you know, there are irrigation wells set up there. At the same time, I will note that, you know, in order to set up our facility, we've actually had to take out a few of the irrigation pivots and wells. And at the end of the day, we've kind of done the math here, and we're not really going to be using any more water on this site than what's historically been used.
Mm-hmm. When you take land like this that's been basically agricultural, you're turning it into pasture land in turn to be able to raise cows and to provide the milk, the organic products that you're going to be putting out from the dairy. What kind of work that you have to do just to make the change over from what the land had been before into pasture land? Is there any real – is it just letting it kind of go fallow? Are you making some official changes that you have to make?
So really the process involves just being or farming organically. Even though you can't sell these crops for conventional, you still have to do it in organic matter.
Right.
And as of July, we will then be certified organic. But again, it comes down to growing these crops – No herbicides, no pesticides, no GMO seeds or anything like that. Doing that all properly and showing that you've done that for 3 years. And then at that point in time, then you can be called certified organic.
Now, once you get things certified and the pasture land is ready for the cows to come in, and you bring the livestock in, as you say, from the plain states coming into northern Indiana, how long does it take to get them to graze and produce milk and in turn get the product out to the markets? And what type of markets are going to be interested in taking on organic milk?
Sure. I guess really where we're providing our milk is mainly to private label grocers as fluid milk. And when we bring these cows in, most of these are going to be milking animals, and we need to make sure that when you bring them in, that first thing you got to do is you got to take care of them. You got to give them water, you got to feed them, and you got to milk them.
Now, are there any markets that are set up or are being set up here to be able to handle the product that's going to come out from the Natural Prairie Dairy?
We are engaged with a few local grocers.
That's great. So there will be product that folks here in Northwest Indiana will be able to buy in the organic dairy section of the stores. You say you're working on the markets right now. How difficult is it to find a market for organic milk here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, organic milk is a market just like any other market where it's subject to supply and demand conditions. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that, I guess, the market go up and down a little bit lately. But I think overall there's still a strong market for organic milk.
Yeah. We've talked here about the product that's going to come out from the dairy once the cows are on the land and grazing and eating and creating milk. What kind of a work have you had to do up to this point now in trying to be a good neighbor to Northwest Indiana, since it's been basically just agricultural land up to this point? Now you're talking about creating a dairy farm.
Yes. And one of those part of, I guess, establishing a dairy farm here is you don't just come in and build one of these and set these up and then leave town 5-10 years later. Mm-hmm. We want to be in Newton County for a very long time, and part of that is being a good neighbor. And we know that if we're going to be a good neighbor, we got to be good environmental stewards as well. So you can't have one without the other. So that is certainly something that we've been spending a lot of time making sure that we're doing not only what's, I guess, required of us through rules and regulations, but also taking the time to see where can we go above and beyond what's required.
Yeah. We know in recent weeks here there have been some community meetings. In fact, there was one community meeting here on Friday, April 20th to talk more about the farm. When you have these meetings set up here, what do you tell the folks here in northern Newton County and southern Lake County, which will be parts of, the neighbors that you will have here as around your dairy farm? What have you talked with them about here? What information have you passed on to them?
Sure, and we were able to attend this meeting last Friday in Lake Village, and I think it was a great opportunity. We said we were there to simply listen, learn, and address where we can. Mm-hmm. And I think it all goes back to our message of traceability and sustainability. We want to be here for a long time in Newton County, and again, it comes down to being environmentally conscious of what you're doing and taking the time to explain to people. Sometimes there's things that are misunderstood, and sometimes there's things that we didn't quite hear them on either. So just taking the time to fully understand what people's concerns are and addressing them as much as we can.
When you set up such a large dairy farm is what you're planning for here on this property in Newton County, and then you're dealing with not only taking care of the cows, feeding them, getting the water to them so that they're grazing and they're producing the milk and all, and then you've got the waste products, of course, that come out of a large farm like this. What have you had to set up, or are you setting up in this particular case to deal with that? Because that's I guess part of the end product. That's the other end, so to speak, here where the milk is coming going to market here. And you're taking care of the cows and all. What special things do you have to do in particular because this is going to be an organic dairy?
Sure, and I guess I would frame that by saying, you know, we always have one kind of key mantra when we're doing things, and that's the real message is if you take care of the land and you take care of the cows and you take care of your people, they will take care of you. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I want to frame this around is because ultimately, yes, there is that end product, and what we're doing with that end product is we're going to be collecting it every single day and processing it mm-hmm. every single day. And when you put it back out on the land, when you apply it, we apply it at what's called the agronomic rate.
Right.
And really what that is applying it for exactly what the crop's intakes needs are. So the growing crop has a specific need for, say, nitrogen or phosphorus, and you apply it for exactly what that crop needs. So one of the things we're doing is we're investing in a technology that allows us to have better control of these nutrients that come out of the manure.
Is this going to be a different setup than, say, what would be considered the average confined animal feeding lot or lot of some sort? I guess most people think of CAFOs, they think in terms of pigs primarily here, and we're talking about cows. Is there any difference between the animals? And because we're talking about this different size of an operation compared to a huge pork-producing operation?
Sure, and I'd say one of the biggest things is one that we're organic, and you know these animals have to graze mm-hmm. for 120 days of the year, so that is a big part of it.
I guess in closing, Will, when you talk about trying to be an operation that's going in turn to provide organic dairy products for not only for the markets here in Northwest Indiana, but hopefully beyond, and you talk about being good stewards of the environment as well, and as well as being good neighbors, it's a challenge, I would imagine, but is this one that you think is surmountable that you're able to be able to do that you'll be able to be everything to everybody in this respect?
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, us coming up here into Indiana is a huge opportunity, but also a huge investment. And we're not going to do this unless we know that we can do it right. And that's why we're here, is because we believe what we're doing is right and that we can do it successfully and making sure that we're environmentally conscious of everything that we do, too.
Now, you've given us a little timetable here about getting the land ready for grazing to bring the cows in so they'll be able to enjoy themselves, get acclimated, because when you're moving livestock around, moving for certainly from a great distance, like in this case, you're moving them up from the Plain States up here to Indiana. How long does it take, I guess, for them to get used to the land, feel comfortably grazing out there? And I'm sure it won't take very long. They'll find something tasty to eat, and they'll start getting acclimated to being here in Northern Indiana and in turn producing milk. How soon would you hope to have the product? And you're working on the markets right now, but are we looking at yet this summer or this fall?
You know, I think at this point in time, we're probably looking a little bit into 2019 as we take some more time to, mm-hmm. I guess, slow down and address all of the concerns and listen, understand what's going on around us. But like I said, one of the main things that we're excited about, I guess two of the things, is one is the pasture up here. This is a very different environment than Texas, and we're excited about the potential for what kind of pasture quality we can have up here. And secondly, you know, being able to take the time to evaluate some of this new technology we're looking at for manure processing.
For Lakeshore Update, I'm Chris Nolte.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program's link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.